This is Seattle's Morning News, and for Dave Ross, I'm Aaron Granillo. President Trump looks to thread a fine needle this weekend, convincing Republicans to vote in a Senate runoff race in Georgia, simultaneously claiming some votes there were tossed out in the last election. Moderator of CBS's Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan, joins us now. And Margaret, tell us what we can expect to hear from President Trump tomorrow in Georgia.
Well, the president is going to Georgia on a mission to help his party drive up support for the two Republican candidates that are in runoff races for Senate seats in the state. This matters to Republicans because it could be the determining factor of whether or not they have the majority in Congress in the new year. But what is sort of at odds with the president's message or his own claims that it's not just that he has a problem with the overall election results that show Joe Biden as the president-elect. He has been specifically attacking elections officials in Georgia, Republican elections officials, and also attacking the Republican governor of that state, accusing him of somehow, not being an ally and somehow helping this conspiracy against him. So the president is saying two contradictory things at the same time, which is come out and vote in the election and don't trust your election systems officers. So it is yet to be seen whether this strategy is going to work or not. And you have some very prominent Republicans, including, former Speaker Newt Gingrich, coming out and saying, ignore what the president's lawyers are telling you. You can trust the election. Come out and vote. So this is once again the president at odds with his party.
Do Republicans want him there in Georgia?
Well, here's the thing. Republicans are looking at two things. One is they really dislike the president's message and rhetoric and that of his lawyers. But then they look at the numbers and they see 74 million people voted for President Trump in this last election in the face of what has been the most significant public health crisis in our nation's history. And he still had ardent supporters. So there's fear that the president still has some major influence and could have it even when he's out of office. So the president is seen as a political power tool in some ways for the Republican Party, the one that they somewhat are concerned could be hurting them at the same time. But they really want his supporters to come out.
And Margaret, you'll be speaking this Sunday with Christopher Krebs. He's the former federal election security chief who was fired by the president after saying the election was not rigged anywhere in this country, including Georgia.
That's right. He was the Trump-appointed official, a lifelong Republican, in charge of guarding the security of our national infrastructure around elections. It is states that run your local election, but the cyber protections around it, the Homeland Security Department tries to protect, and that's what Chris Krebs says he did, and that it did it well. And so it was shocking that the president publicly attacked him, in fact, has threatened him. Some of the president's allies shockingly came out and called for him to be killed, to be executed. And that is just rhetoric that is so incredibly dangerous that even in the state of Georgia, a Republican elections officials have come out and said, stop. Enough is enough. This is beyond the pale. This is damaging to our democracy, to our institutions, and someone is going to take you literally. This is really, really dangerous rhetoric. So the president is making some of his Republican Party allies very uncomfortable, who fear that there could be some security implications. And certainly for Chris Krebs and his family, I'm sure it's very concerning.
And we should note that no lawsuit, no review, no audit, no recount in any state has had enough evidence to overturn the outcome of the election.
That's right. There has been no evidence that has been upheld in a court of law, notably in front of Republican Trump-appointed judges who have thrown out these cases again and again. So the president and his allies, his legal allies like Rudy Giuliani, his attorney, these are conspiracies. They are nothing more at this point. Nothing so far has been substantiated. And you have national security officials saying, trust the American vote. And more broadly, that this language and rhetoric shouldn't be a game, that it undermines our democratic institutions. And if the president doesn't like the outcome of the election, he should run again. But don't tell the public that the system is rigged.
Let's shift now to the pandemic and the COVID-19 vaccine specifically. States face a deadline today to submit requests for doses of the Pfizer vaccine. This is the candidate that needs to be stored at very low temperatures. So how is the federal government preparing for this monumental task of mass distribution?
It's really an incredible operation, Operation Warp Speed, that the Trump administration put together with, you know, the logistics help of the U.S. military. But really, once that dissemination, once that spread of the vaccine takes place, once the federal government hands it off, it's going to be in the hands of the states, and it's going to be up to your local governors to make the decisions on who gets it. The CDC, the federal government, is recommending and providing guidelines to those governors, but the governors can do what they want. They can follow the guidelines or they can choose not to. So this is going to be in the hands of your local officials and also in the hands of some private businesses, because there are also companies like FedEx involved in shipping, companies like CVS and Walgreens, pharmacies, who will be the places ultimately that will be the points of distribution for these vaccines. So this is something that we will be tracking closely as it rolls out over the next weeks and months ahead.
And here in Washington State, we should mention that our Governor Jay Inslee has prioritized healthcare workers for the first round of doses, along with vulnerable adults, people in nursing homes, and people of that nature. This all comes, of course, as the U.S. continues shattering records for hospitalizations, along with daily confirmed cases and deaths. What are public health doctors now warning could come as we brace now for the post-Thanksgiving travel surge?
Isn't it staggering that the numbers we're talking about now, which are breathtaking, we had nearly 3,000 deaths on Wednesday alone, that we are now at over 100,000 people hospitalized per day, that we are now looking at a case count of about 14 million people infected in this country with over 200,000 infections per day, that those numbers aren't reflecting the surge. Okay, those are where we are now. We haven't seen the impact yet, according to Dr. Fauci, of the travel that happened over Thanksgiving. Brace yourself. That's why we are going out to those frontline workers. We are going to talk to the CEO of Nebraska Medical Center about what he has seen out there in the Great Plains, in the Midwest, that has been hit so hard of late. That medical center is also full of infectious disease specialists. So this is one of the places that would have been best prepared. And we want to talk to them about how they've been handling it, what hospitals around the country need to be bracing for, because we have made so much progress on therapeutics, on research, in dealing with the disease itself, with the virus. But at a certain point, the sheer volume of infections may overwhelm that.
Margaret Brennan is moderator of CBS's Face the Nation. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind local places and things. This week, 20 years before that mysterious monolith turned up in the Utah desert, the Seattle monolith took the city by surprise on New Year's Day 2001, Felix.
Good morning, Aaron. You know, I'm not a big fan of that 1960s movie, 2001 yeah. Space Odyssey, but 20 years ago, when the actual year 2001 was just a few weeks away, a group of artists was busy preparing to pull off a practical joke here in Seattle that would pay tribute to that movie. Now, the Seattle monolith appeared on New Year's Day on Kite Hill at Magnuson Park. It was 9 feet tall, made out of dark-colored steel, kind of like a big narrow metal box, and it was pretty elaborate. The installers had secretly poured a concrete footing for it a few days before New Year's. They weren't just messing around. Now, this was before social media and before all phones had cameras, so there aren't any images of it that I can get my hands on, but it was quite the spectacle. Then a few days later, it disappeared, and then it reappeared, but this time it was on Duck Island at Green Lake. I mean, people's heads were spinning. It was so bizarre. It moved around a few more times after that and eventually ended up in someone's backyard. Now, the Seattle Times reporter Tyrone Beeson uncovered most of the mystery back in late 2002. One element that's never really been told is where the money came from to pay for the materials to build the monolith. So on December 2nd, 2000, that's 20 years ago this week, there was an event called the Apes of Wrath. It was an amateur wrestling event held in an old building on Westlake Avenue, kind of a fairly elaborate amateur wrestling showcase. Now, I was part of that event. I didn't know the organizers. I didn't know what we were raising money for. But my old friend Ken Zick was one of the two announcers, and we have some very lo-fi archival audio.
For those of you who are wondering what the Monolith Foundation is, it's in the time-honored tradition of dressing up in the ridiculous costumes and making total fools of ourselves in public. Some People are welcoming you to the Apes of Wrath Wrestling Party, a fundraiser for the Some People's Monolith Project. The funds received from this event will be used to build an evolutionary generator, which will be turned on at the beginning of the new millennium.
So Ken was reading that. He didn't know what he was saying. He was just reading off a card there. Now, I was the other announcer. We have some audio of me as well.
Okay, we've got a standoff now. We've got Owen calling for... Okay, he's taking them both at a time. Both are dispatched with immediacy by Owen Lotz. Oh, and the knee crunch to the crotch. An elbow crunch to the crotch. He gets him around the middle. He's got him up. He's going to spin him around. Looks like baggy pants and all. Oh! Wow.
I think that was the second. I think that was the second wrestling event I served in an announcer at. As anyway, it was a different, much more innocent time 20 years ago. It feels like 100 years ago, but that building is still standing on Westlake, and that little bit of the monolith mystery still lives on here 20 years later.
You missed your calling as a ringside announcer there.
Hey, I'm available for parties, bar mitzvahs, you name it, whatever.
Felix Minnell, thank you for the time. Seattle's Morning News, and for Dave Ross, I'm Aaron Granillo. With hundreds of jobs on the line, King County looks to rescue the new convention center with a $100 million loan, but this will not be the last of the help the project likely needs. More details from Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
If we don't have additional funds to basically complete this project, we'll have to stop in 10 to 12 months.
That was the warning from project leaders back in May as damage from the early months of the pandemic decimated the tourism industry and the project's funding source along with it.
The convention center now faces a $300 million financing crunch that threatens to mothball the project and put future economic development at risk. I'm not going to sit by and watch that happen.
King County Executive Dow Constantine announcing a possible bailout.
Instead, King County is considering all the tools at its disposal, including a $100 million loan to the convention center that would be paid back with interest at the rate of 1%, which matches the rate of return on our investment pool.
That's the pool of county dollars the loan would come from.
The investment pool currently stands at $3.4 billion. So this proposed $100 million loan is a relatively small amount, but it would make a tremendous difference in our region.
The $1.9 billion project is one of the largest construction projects King County has ever seen, and it's well underway, with construction starting back in 2018 and an original opening date set for 2022. It was funded through bonds repaid by future lodging tax revenue, which had been increasing about 8% every year in the years leading up to the project, but took a massive hit when the pandemic arrived, leading to a huge drop in hotel stays, 90% drop in revenue for that industry. On top of that, nearly 70 conventions have been scrapped since the start of the pandemic, and there's no guarantee that this industry will bounce back to what it used to be. But shutting the project down means 1,000 jobs on the line. Building Trades Union Chief Monty Anderson stressing the importance of those jobs.
It's not just a job for us, but these are careers. The convention center has gone out of the way to attract a lot of women and people of color into the apprenticeship programs and put them to work on there. We owe these people the ability to work and bring back a fair wage to their family. Can you imagine us shutting this down? $60,000 to $70,000 a day lost out of the economy out of working class people's hands?
Project leader Matt Griffin elaborated.
We went out of our way to basically plan it for a diverse community. We have about 30% people of color on the job, 25% from priority zip codes, 17% from apprentices. We have over $100 million and 100 different contracts with women and minority-owned businesses. These are the people that will get put out of work. And they're the people, at least personally, I feel, in our pandemic, are the ones that have suffered the most.
But asked whether this $100 million loan would be enough.
As we said in the spring, we have a financing question of about $300 million. So, no, this is not enough. It is one piece, and we're hoping that discussions that have started with the city and with the state will allow us to put together a program from those three governmental entities.
While some have been critical of the funding plan for the project from the start, including former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, who the Seattle Times says likened the strategy to hopping into a cab with no money to pay and hoping your roommate can cover it, others believe this is for the greater good. King County Council Budget Chair Jeannie Cole Wells.
Perhaps at no other time in our region's history has it been more critical to fight tooth and nail to save every existing family wage job.
The loan would ultimately have to get approval from the county's executive finance committee, which includes Cole Wells and several members of Constantine's staff. Constantine is sure the county will get a return on this investment.
I'm absolutely confident. Unless you believe that no one will ever travel to Seattle and King County again.
But he also made clear,
we need the federal government to help the American people. That is their job, and they must step up to it.
Cover Radio's Hannah Scott reporting. Colleen, let's talk about some kindness, shall we?
Okay, let's do it. Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by your real estate agent, Mike Novak, and listwithnovak.com. The pandemic has forced countless events to be canceled this year, including a whole lot of sports games. But there is one event in Georgia that's been reinvented as a drive-through, hosted by a 13-year-old boy who's made it his mission to help others. CBS's Janet Shamlian has the story.
Hi, my name is CJ Matthews.
CJ Matthews hosts a flag football game called the Giving Bowl every December. It's a fundraiser for a charity he started, giving blankets to children who in some way are struggling.
What's special about giving someone a blanket?
Because a blanket, it's warm, and it's comfortable.
COVID canceled this year's contest, but not the 13-year-old's mission. A drive-through donation event netted 150 blankets. Cash donations will allow him to give away almost 1,000.
He has a heart of gold. He always has.
When he hands the blankets over, he says he hopes kids realize, even this year, kindness has not been canceled.
It's going to feel really good to me because I'm helping another soul be happy in life.
Janet Shamlian, CBS News, Houston.
Kids always know the right thing to do if we just get out of their way. Mm-hmm. The trend in these doses of kindness has always been kids showing adults the way. Yeah. We don't need to teach kids anything. They know. We should follow them more.
And now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio. It is G Scott. Happy Blue Friday, G.
Yay. Happy Blue Friday, brother.
The Red Hot Giants are coming to Lumen Field. They've won 3 in a row. They're first place in the NFC East, but they're also only 4-7. So what do we make of the Giants?
They're an NFL football team, and anything can happen on any given Sunday. They are going to be without their starting quarterback, Daniel Jones, who's kind of had a little leg injury right now. So I'm trying to remember who's going to be the backup quarterback. But if that quarterback doesn't happen, if there's an emergency, come to find out, yes, Golden Tate would have to be the emergency quarterback. We all know Golden Tate. Remember him from his time here with Seattle. But this Giants team, here's the thing. They are in the NFC East division. And in that division, they don't win many games. However, here's something to remember. All you need to do is make the playoffs. And to take you guys down memory lane, mm-hmm. 2010, when the Seahawks, when they made it to the playoffs, when they had the record that they did during that time. So it is.
They're like 7-9 back then, Jesus, something like that.
They were 9-7. They were 7-9.
7-9, yeah.
Yeah. So
I want you to spill the tea, G, on Golden Tate. So is there still bad blood between me and Russell Wilson?
We're going there.
Didn't he steal Russell's girl?
No, he did not steal. No, not at all. Golden is married today to the gal that he had met here his rookie year when he was in Seattle. She's a wonderful person, and they have two beautiful children.
Say anything about Golden Tate. Sounds like you guys are buddies.
It is my buddy, but at the same time, I'm telling you the truth. Yes.
It's all rumors then. There is no bad blood between Russell Wilson and Golden Tate.
I don't know about their relationships. I don't know about that. When I talk to Golden, we don't even discuss Russell at all. We talk about family. We talk about his kids. Talk about his charities and all those stuff. We talk about missing him here. As a matter of fact,
Real Housewives drama when I watch this game.
But wait. I like them Real Housewives shows, right?
Yeah.
I was just watching Real Housewives of Salt Lake City last night. But anyways,
how is that? I always wondered how can they. I didn't know Salt Lake was known for its housewives.
I mean, come on now, Colleen. Every place has housewives, so it's all good. Right. It's good. It's really good. But look, Golden was here at a time where, you know, he was part of a winning team. And, of course, the Seahawks are still winning. So I'm quite sure he misses that winning nature. But he's gone on to be successful. And
Was it Russell that got him kicked off the team?
No, it was free agency that gagged Golden Tate. I mean, that's what happens, right? A lot of people don't make it. It's business transactions. No, I am not. There is nothing to that reason as to why Golden Tate is not on the team.
Any other questions, Colleen?
To the sports talk. 7-9, 9-7, Nickelback, all that.
Hey,
good
that was
stuff.
The year of the Beastquake. No, let's not forget that, right? Gee, that was the year of the Beastquake when the Saints came to town.
Man, and that game was amazing. Yeah. That was an amazing game, and they, you know, and that. Okay, so let's talk about that. That's all it takes. It just takes making it to the playoffs. So you have the Giants team. They have some confidence right now. They are in first place, and they have an opportunity to come out here and get into sole possession of the first place going forward. The Dallas Cowboys aren't playing well right now. The Washington football team, they're kind of iffy a little bit. So the Giants are really coming here to try to get a game like this. And then think about it. If they were to win a game like this on Sunday here in Seattle, that would give them so much confidence going forward. So, again, it's still going to be a tough game. But if there's one thing we know about the Seahawks game, every game is different, but every game is the same. So no matter what teams come in here, you guys know it is going to be a close game somehow.
So what's the final score going to be, G?
I got 32-26. Just getting random.
You don't trust our defense against a backup quarterback? At home?
No, no, there's not any
26
disrespect.
Points?
No, it's a new NFL these days, right? Yeah. Like, it's really easy to score points for offenses considering they don't let you touch the wide receivers. They don't let you touch the quarterbacks. So it's kind of an offensive game.
Gotcha. All right. G. Scott, listen to him 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio. Thank you, G. Seattle's Morning News, Aaron Grinnello sitting in for Dave Ross on this Friday morning. Some key pieces of Northwest history are at risk of being moved away. Our resident historian Felix Bunnell first broke the news almost a year ago that the federal government would try to sell the National Archives building in Seattle. Now our Attorney General Bob Ferguson is suing the Trump administration to stop the sale. He and Felix join us now. And Mr. Ferguson, first tell us what the basis of your lawsuit says.
Sure, Aaron. Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on. And the basis is, at the bottom line, this is a complicated case, as they often are, but essentially that the federal government, these agencies that are deep in the bowels of the federal government, are not following basic federal laws in making this sale of this property. It's worth pointing out, by the way, we discovered that they were going to do this, accelerate the sale of the property to just in January. We discovered this in a minutes meeting from an October meeting that's 74 pages long that my staff just happened to notice on a webpage. In other words, they gave absolutely zero notice to my office or to anybody else, as far as we know, despite them knowing, the federal government knowing, of the intense interest in the subject here in the Northwest. It's truly outrageous what they're doing. I'm so appreciative my staff discovered this, buried on this website, and now we're going to take action to put a stop to it.
Felix?
Yeah, Attorney General Ferguson, this esoteric federal agency that's moving forward with the sale and who did that very opaque process, you know, more than a year ago to identify it in the first place, it's called the Public Buildings Reform Board. They appear to have been created in a way that makes them really independent and able to move very quickly with little or no regard to how I feel or you feel or anyone feels. Can a lawsuit actually stop them at this point?
Yeah, we feel confident we can't stop them. Your point is well taken, Felix. This obscure board does have a lot of ability to move these properties, but there are still very basic foundational federal laws that apply even to this board. So it's worth pointing out, just to give you a sense of how outrageous their conduct is. We did a Freedom of Information request, filed a lawsuit 9 months ago to get documents from this group as well as others about how this decision got made. They've not turned over any documents at all. And in fact, they recently asked the judge to delay having them respond till March. Guess what? At the same time, they want the sale to go through in January. So we'll never know. We'd never get those documents if this sale is allowed to go through. So Felix, to that question, I can't believe a federal judge is going to allow that to happen. to allow this entity to delay for a year turning over basic documents, at the same time accelerate the sale, no public process, no public input, without us ever knowing what their thinking was.
Yeah, and National Archives officials told me it would take several years to move everything out of that Seattle facility.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it was sold in January, whoever bought it would then be paid rent by the federal government for at least a couple years while that material was being moved. So there wouldn't be any cost savings necessarily. On a political side, if the sale is end up, say you are able to delay the sale, and if the Biden administration is more sympathetic to keeping the National Archives in Seattle, you think this issue could potentially go away with sort of a new cast of characters at these various agencies?
Well, there certainly are, to your point, Felix, multiple tracks in which we'll be addressing this. In my office, of course, we can use litigation, making sure these federal agencies follow federal law. We are, of course, in communication with our congressional delegation. Our U.S. senators have a big interest. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal has a big interest. We've notified them of this latest development of what these agencies are doing. And so, yes, to answer your question, it is certainly our hope that our congressional delegation can get the attention of the new Biden administration and working through Congress put a stop to. We want to be clear, there are like a dozen properties around the country that they want to sell. Most of them, as you know, Felix, are like abandoned warehouses. Mm-hmm. There's nothing of any value to any local community across the country. Here, these archives, if you care about your family genealogy, if you're a tribal member, if you care about the Chinese Exclusion Act here in Washington State, these are documents that are core to our history right here in Washington State. My late father went out to the archives all the time to do research on our family and the history of our family. It's outrageous what they're doing, and more specifically, the way in which they are doing it. Yeah.
And one last question for you. How soon might this come before a judge? How soon might we know if you're successful in sort of shutting down this sale?
Yeah, that I can answer fairly specifically. It's our intention right now to file our lawsuit in the first part of January. Could be a little bit earlier, might be a little bit later. But right now, the way they've set this up is it looks like they're going to hire a broker in early January and proceed with the sale later in January. So to your point, Felix, we have to, by necessity, move very quickly. The good news is my team's been working on this for a long, long time. They're not starting from a standing position. They've been working on this for a while. It's how they actually discovered this 74-page document in which this change in sale has been identified. So we'll be ready to go, I'd say, in the next 3 to 4 weeks.
It's Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson and our resident historian Felix Bunnell. Thank you to you both.
Thanks, Thank you. You can ring my
bell. Ring your bell. You're listening to Seattle's Morning News. And for Dave Ross, I'm Aaron Granillo. Joining us now, Rachel Bell. And Rachel, you are here to tell us why we should not blame 2020 for all the bad that has happened in the past few months.
I'm sure everybody has either heard it or said it. 2020 is the worst. This is the worst year. I can't wait till the year is over. And maybe I'm a pessimist, but the first thing I always think is January is going to be the same as December. But this article that was on Medium is talking about this in a more psychiatric manner. So, of course, 2020 has been a really hard year. The pandemic, the death of George Floyd and all kinds of racial injustice, the election, people can't wait for the year to be over. But the problem that they say in the article is something that's defined as magical thinking by psychologists, which is basically blaming a bunch of bad things on something else and not taking any steps to make it better for yourself. So it's, in their words, this false hope that the negative events of this year are caused by the year itself and will get better with the passing of the year is an example of magical thinking. So they explain it like this. Our brains like to take shortcuts. And so if there is chaos and uncertainty, we look for a pattern. And in this case, the pattern is, well, everything bad happened this year, it must be 2020's fault. Now, they say it's okay if you just think of these things every now and then. But for people who really kind of get fixated on it, it is bad because what you're doing is completely removing yourself from this problem and becoming powerless to it. And then it becomes this unhelpful coping mechanism that can turn into depression. So what they recommend is to focus on the things you can control instead of blaming everything on a year, which is not a person, place, or thing. It's just an inanimate idea. Focus on the things that are bothering you and try to do small things to make yourself feel better. So if you're really, really worried about getting COVID, then you have the ability to wear a mask, to isolate yourself. You know, there's things that you can do to kind of get some control, but it doesn't involve blaming a year.
Yeah, I fall somewhere in the middle here because, of course, it's not 2020 that caused COVID to happen. COVID happened in 2020, right? But at the same time, I think it's okay to kind of look forward
to 2021. And I think from a psychological standpoint, it might be even healthy to say 2021 is going to be better than 2020 was, right? Isn't that okay to say?
Oh, yeah, I think you're right. I think that's the only way to get through this is to recognize that it is a temporary problem. Yeah. But I guess what they're saying, it kind of reminds me of, you know, I turned 40 last January and the day before I was 39, the next day I was 40. And that's an invention of humans making up, you know, time and how long a year is and all of that. So I always feel annoyed at that. Like, how do you feel today? It's like, I feel the same way as I did yesterday. Like, I didn't have a freak out about turning 40 because, you know, you just keep moving on, like nothing's different. And so I guess I kind of think that with, they bring up in this article too, you know, New Year's resolutions fall into the same idea of blaming a year for a pandemic, deciding that, oh, this was a bad year, I'm going to make resolutions for next year. I think it can go both ways. If you actually follow through, then that's like you're saying, just feeling positive about change in the future. But if it doesn't work out, then you kind of blame that year and you feel like you're a failure because you didn't do something, then it doesn't work out so well.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, sort of old cliches that come up with this story. I mean, control what you can control. And that's probably the best advice that you can always give, right?
I think we're all going to remember 2020. We're going to remember it very well. That's kind of, I think, how I've coped with it was, you know, Thanksgiving was very different. And for me, it was two people and it wasn't the way that it normally was. But I will never forget it. And so I kind of, I kind of liked that psychologically, just thinking, well, if it has to be this way, this is going to be something in history that, you know, other generations are going to ask about. What was it like having a pandemic and Thanksgiving? I mean, we're storytellers. I love telling stories. I feel like already by next year, it'll be a good story to tell.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.